There's a version of Winter Wonderland we'd like to dedicate to the Jamaican bobsled team. Anton Schwartz on tenor saxophone, Art Hirahara piano, John Watala bass, and Tim Buckley on drums, and that version of Winter Wonderland. Anton Schwartz, again, featured this Thursday at noon in the Jingle Bell Jazz Concert, broadcast live on KPLU at noon on Thursday. Jay Thomas and the Cantaloupes before that, with Jay on tenor sax and flugelhorn, Michael Van Baber trumpet, Dan Marcus trombone, John Hansen piano, Michael Glenn bass, and Adam Kessler on drums, playing Mulgrew Miller's tune Sol Leo. Stay tuned for Ken Wiley and the Art of Jazz coming up next. My name's Jim Wilkie. Hope you've enjoyed our music today. Next week on the show, the Mark Taylor Don Clement Group, recorded live at Tula's during the Earshot Jazz Festival. That'll be featured next Sunday here on Jazz Northwest. I'll also be recording the Mark Seals Trio at the Seattle Art Museum this coming Thursday, and we'll bring you that recording a little later on this month. We also have a number of recordings coming up from the Earshot Jazz Festival that'll be heard early next year. You're listening to KPLU Tacoma, Seattle at 88.5, KPLI Olympia 90.1, KVIX Port Angeles, Victoria 89.3, KPLK Cedro Woolley 88.9, and streaming worldwide at kplu.org.
This is the Art of Jazz. I'm Ken Wiley. I'm getting settled here with my coffee and my notes and all. And also, today's Art of Jazz will be shorter than usual. The President, President Obama, will address the nation from the Oval Office. this evening at 5, and we here will carry it live for you. I'd like to start with the Firehouse 5 Plus 2, Los Angeles 1949 for Good Time Jazz. Thank you. Firehouse 5 Plus 2, L.A. 1949, Firehouse Stomp and Blues My Naughty Sweetie Gives to Me, Good Time Jazz Records. Johnny Lucas Trumpet, Ward Kimball Trombone, Clark Mallory Clarinet, Frank Thomas Piano, Harper Goff Banjo, Ed Penner playing bass sax, and Jim McDonald right there on the drums. And, oh, well, I'm going to do this. This is 88.5 KPLU and streaming at kplu.org. And support for KPLU comes from...
All Things Considered goes where you are and takes you places you've never thought to go.
Right now, the wildfire threat in the Pacific Northwest is...
This month marks 10 years since Katrina bore
Michael
down.
Brown in Ferguson, Eric Garner in New York, Tamir Rice in Cleveland.
And every day, the KPLU news team takes you from riverbanks with spawning salmon to the inner offices of our state capitol to tell you more about the place you live.
There's more to every story.
All Things Considered, weekdays from 3 to 6:30 on KPLU.
And now a couple of artists for you, two pieces from each one. George Shearing at the piano for Savoy Records 1948 with Curly Russell bass and Denzel Best on the drums, and then Etta Jones, RCA Victor, 1946. Thank you.
Among I'm blue and I'm disgusted. Better keep away from me. So blue and disgusted. Better keep away from me. I can't control my temper. I'm as mean as I can be. You can say I'm temperamental, but I'm really up a tree. I waited for my baby, but he didn't wait for me. I've got the blues. It's the blues to end all blues. Don't want no more loving. There ain't no other man I can use. Now patience is a virtue. I've been patient long enough. Instead of all this virtue, I'm gonna get real tough. I've got the blues. It's the blues to end all blues. Don't want no more loving. There ain't no other man I can use. If he comes back home the front way, I'll put him on the floor. If he comes back through the window, I'll throw him out the door. I've got the blues. It's the blues to end all blues. Don't want no more loving. There ain't no other man I can use.
George Shearing Trio started that set. 1948 for Savoy Records. His piano, Curly Russell bass, Denzel Best on drums, Sophisticated Lady by Duke Ellington, and Bop's Your Uncle, written by Shearing. Etta Jones for Victor Records, 1946, Among My Souvenirs, and Blues to End All Blues. George Treadwell on trumpet, Richard Harris trombone, wonderful soloing by Bud Johnson. On tenor saxophone, Jimmy Jones at the piano, Al McKibben on bass, J.C. Hurd leading the band and playing the drums, George Shearing and Etta Jones, right here on 88.5 KPLU and streaming at kplu.org. Count Basie now. 1937, John's Idea, and then the classic 1 o'clock jump. Then, following that, Harry James, trumpet in his band, 1938, borrowing Herschel Evans from Count Basie's band and their version for Columbia Records of 1 o'clock jump. The top of 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 the top of
Thank you.
Count Basie started the set by doing two for you from Decca Records 1937, John's Idea and 1 o'clock Jump. And then a year later, 1938, for Columbia Records, Harry James said, I'm going to do that one. And he did. And he borrowed Herschel Evans to play tenor on it. And fine work on piano also by Jess Stacy, Count Basie, and Harry James. 88.5 KPLU and streaming at KPLU.org. Josh White now to sing for you, 1945.
Did you ever love a woman? Yes, in love with all your mind. Did you ever love a woman and love her with all your mind? And you know that all the time that that woman wasn't treating you right. Yeah, she loved that woman so much, why she almost drives you mad. You love that woman so much, she almost drives you mad. But still you wouldn't quit her, 'cause she had the best old something that you ever had. You fix her breakfast every morning, stay home every day, even wash the dishes if she has to go away. Why, you send the kids to school, even mend the hose, stay up all night with the baby, and you wash her dirty clothes. But when it's time to go to bed, that woman grabs you real tight. Why, she takes you in her arms and then she squeezes you with all her might. She calls you lots of sweet names and then you turn out all the lights. That woman set your soul on fire, holler, baby, everything's alright. That's why you love that woman. Yes, you love her with all your might. And you know you can't quit her, when all the time you know she treats you right.
Everywhere, I've done everything, from building planes to hauling steel. But since I left home, I've been on my own, needing you like a home-cooked meal. Oh, it's too bad I ever left my hometown, left a good deal in Mobile. Oh, why did I leave there? I can't believe there's a train on the track. I'd give a great stack to hop a freight back, but if I should, it won't do me no good. Bought me a car to go where you are, with initials on the steering wheel. I wrote you and Jack, both letters came back. I guess you know the way I feel. Yeah, it's too bad I ever left my hometown. Left a good deal in Mobile. Oh, why did I leave that? I can't believe there's a train on the track. I'd give a great stack to hop a freight back, but if I should, it won't do me no good. Fuller Brush Man, he told me a plan. He gave it to me for a steal. He said to ask Gwen, then getting her hair, I'd find out if her love was real. Oh, it's too bad I ever left my hometown. Left a good deal in Mobile. Mobile, Mobile, that's my home.
Josh White singing for you, 1945, Decca Records, Edmund Hall's clarinet, his band behind him. Did You Ever Love a Woman, written by Dwight Gatemouth Moore. And I Left a Good Deal in Mobile. Herb Jefferson, Nat Leslie wrote that one. Ellis Larkin's on the piano. Eddie Williams sneaking in there for some fine work on tenor saxophone. Fine work. This is 88.5 KPLU and streaming at kplu.org. Support for KPLU comes from
Pacific Lutheran University, now offering a non-credit certificate in maritime management for working professionals. Information about this and other continuing education programs is available at plu.edu/continuing-ed.
Sidney Bechet, clarinet, soprano, sax. 1940, Victor Records, Ellington's Stompy Jones, and Don Redman's Save It Pretty Mama. Rex Stewart on trumpet, Bechet, as I said, clarinet or soprano. Earl Hines on the piano, John Lindsay on string bass, and Warren Baby Dodds playing the drums. This is The Art of Jazz. I'm Ken Wiley, and I'd like to bring Save It Pretty Mama up again. This for the classic Louis Armstrong Savoy Ballroom 5 recording for OK Records, Chicago, 1928.
Please, honey, don't give none away. Let it pile up, honey, then if you say, I'll be around soon to spend the day. I have an art of loving that can't be beat. My way of hugging is a treat. I know we can agree, so save it, pretty mama. Save it all for me. We'll be right back. I went down to St. James Infirmary. Saw my baby there, stretched out on the long white table. So sweet, so cold, so fair. Let her go, God bless her. Wherever she may be, she can look this wide world over. She'll never find a sweet man like me. When I die, I want you to dress me straight leg shoes, box back coat, and a studs and hat. Put a $20 gold piece on my watch chain, so the boys will know that I died standing pat.
Strong Savoy Ballroom 5, Chicago, 1928 for OK Records. Save It Pretty Mama by Don Redman and St. James Infirmary by Joe Primrose. Louis on trumpet and vocal, Fred Robinson trombone, Don Redman clarinet and alto. Earl Hines brought in again to play the piano. Dave Wilborn on banjo or guitar on Save It Pretty Mama, and Mancy Cara on St. James Infirmary, and Louis' great friend Zudi Singleton playing drums. Louis Armstrong, right there. You're listening to KPLU 88.5 Tacoma, Seattle, KPLI 90.1 Olympia, KVIX 89.3 Port Angeles, Victoria, KPLK 88.9, Cedro Woolley, and streaming worldwide at kplu.org. This program is The Art of Jazz. It's always a pleasure for me to be with you on Sunday afternoons. Lee Wiley, no relation. Wish she was. She's going to sing for you. Her husband, Jess Stacy, at the piano, and their good friend, Muggsy Spanier, on the cornet.
In the morning, baby, just for a day, someone will get me and take me away. Dee 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 dee. I'm gonna leave you, baby, going down to Steamboat, Tennessee. I'm gonna leave. baby, going down to Steamboat, Tennessee. Cause it's the last time you're gonna grease up them sheets with me. Your New York light shines so nice and bright. Your New York light shines so nice and bright. I'd rather be down home walking by the lantern light. They say the times are coming when a woman won't need a man. They say the times are coming when a woman won't need a man. I'm gonna keep that time from coming if I can. Folks up here say I'm strange and queer. Folks up here say I'm strange and queer. Don't have to be no fortune teller to read what's on any man's mind. Don't have to be no fortune teller to read what's on any man's mind. Too much behind. A better name for one I used to call my baby doll. It ain't new, it ain't old. If you do what you're told, you'll find the answer if you take a look in Mr. Webster's dictionary book. The word is sugar. Sugar, I never may be my sugar, because my sugar is so confectionary funny. He never pleads for my money. All he can give me is honey. He's the best in his line. I'd make a million trips to his lips if I were a bee, 'cause they are sweeter than any honey to me. They're granulated sugar. I get my taffy from sugar. That's why I'm daffy about sugar. That sugar baby of mine.
Lee Wiley started the set singing for you with Jess Stacy at piano, Muggsy Spaniel Cornet, 1940, Commodore Records, down to Steamboat Tennessee, and Sugar by Maceo Pinkard, Edna Alexander, and Sid Mitchell. Then George Ween's piano and his Dixie Victors, 1956, their version of Sugar, and Strutting with Some Barbecue. Ruby Braff cornet, Vic Dickinson trombone, Peanuts Huckle clarinet, Ernie Caceres bass sax, Milt Hinton bass, and Buzzy Druten playing the drums. This is 88.5 KPLU and streaming at kplu.org. Support for KPLU comes from
Butch Blum, downtown Seattle at 6th and Union, presenting their annual Ladies Night Out on December 9th. Co-sponsored by the Robert Leonard Salon, Boca Restaurant, Julep Nail Salon, and Hotel 1000. Reservations limited, RSVP to promotions at butchblum.com.
Maybe I can't live to love you as long as I want to. Life is long enough, baby, but I can love you as long as I live. Maybe I can't give you diamonds, things like I'd want to, but I can promise you, baby, I'm gonna want you as long as I live. I never cared, but now I'm scared I won't live long enough. That's why I wear my rubbers when it rains and eat an apple every day, see the doctor anyway. What if I can't live to love you as long as I want to? Long as I promise you, baby, gonna love you as long as I live. I'm gonna take good care of me, because sneeze a tomb and mean a flu, and that would never, never do. Well, if I can't live to love you as long as I want to, long as I promise you, baby, I'm gonna love you as long as I live. Thank you.
today. You're blowing me no good. No good. Go, will the wind go away? Skies are all so gray around my neighborhood, and that's no good. You're only misleading, the sunshine I'm needing, ain't that a shame? It's so hard to keep up with troubles that creep up from out of nowhere when love's to blame. So ill wind blow away, let me rest today. You're blowing me no good, no good. You're blowing me no good. Thank you.
Composer Harold Arlen sang for you from 1934 two hits that he and Ted Kohler did, As Long As I Live and Ill Wind. And then Art Tatum, 53, in L.A. for Clef Records, did his version of Ill Wind, and Isom Jones, I'll See You in My Dreams. This is 88.5 KPLU and streaming at kplu.org. Support for KPLU comes from
Pacific Lutheran University, now offering a non-credit certificate in maritime management for working professionals. Information about this and other continuing education programs is available at plu.edu/continuing-ed.
call you mine. To know you're mine would be divine. Give me the right to feel that this romance is real and not a lie that you're concealing. Give me your love, I ask of you. No other love could ever do. Give me the right to love you morning, noon, and night. I beg.
Duke Ellington and his orchestra, 1953 for Capitol Records, Buddha, written by Duke, and Give Me the Light by Robert Mellon and Al Frisch, giving Jimmy Grissom a chance to sing for you, Ray Nance a chance to play his trumpet. Duke Ellington, 1953. This is 88.5, excuse me, this is 88.5 KPLU and streaming at kplu.org. Support for KPLU comes from
Bartell Drugs, serving the Puget Sound area with 64 convenient locations, now offering seasonal flu shots for protection in fighting the flu. Locations and more information online at bartelldrugs.com.
I'm Ed Ronco. On All Things Considered, we cover a lot of ground with what's happening in the Northwest, the nation, and the world, but we do it carefully. These days, the click of a mouse or a punch of the remote can unleash an endless bombardment of unfiltered facts and noise. On All Things Considered, we give you the whole story, as well as the time to put it into perspective. That's why our show is called All Things Considered, not All Things Thrown at You All at Once. All Things Considered, weekday afternoons from 3 to 6:30 on KPLU.
Thank you. Oh, friend asks you, haven't you heard the news? When it's all over town that your castle fell down, you've got a date with the blues. If he used to say, I'll call every day, and now he's beginning to pick and choose. That's your warning, my friend, you're approaching the end. You've got a date with the blues. If he used to be exclusively yours, right at your beck and call, but now he's only elusively yours. You'll know that soon he won't be yours at all. When he says goodbye, better ask him why. 'Cause you know now you haven't a thing to lose. And the moment you part, when he hands back your heart, you've got a date with the blues.
Thank you.
Charlie Ventura playing his tenor saxophone for you, his band 1949 and 1950. Birdland, featuring the vocalizing of Jackie Kane and Roy Kral, fine trombone by Benny Green. Edgar Sampson's Lullaby and Rhythm with Jackie Kane doing the soloing singing. They've Got a Date with the Blues by Jane Feather, with an arrangement by Manny Album, with Lucy Reed singing that, and an instrumental of the classic Dark Eyes done by Ventura on his tenor saxophone. Here's Dick Hyman at the solo piano, 1990. Thank you. was Dick Hyman for Reference Recordings in San Francisco, 1990, solo piano. Two rare ones by Thomas Batswaller, African Ripples and Viper's Drag. This has been The Art of Jazz. I'm Ken Wiley, and thanks so much for being out there.
And you're listening to KPLU 88.5 Tacoma, Seattle, KPLI 90.1 Olympia, KVIX 89.3 Port Angeles, Victoria, KPLK 88.9 Cedar Woolley, and streaming worldwide at KPLU.org. Good evening, I'm Kevin Kniestad, and in just a few seconds, KPLU will be bringing you special coverage as President Obama will address the nation from the Oval Office. He is expected to speak about steps the government is taking to address terrorist threats against the country. He is also expected to give an update on the investigation into the San Bernardino shootings. This will be followed by analysis from NPR reporters and correspondents, after which we will return to our regular programming here on KPLU. Again, special coverage as President Obama addresses the nation from the Oval Office. That begins right now, right here on 88.5 KPLU.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. In just a few moments, President Obama will address the nation on the threat from terrorism. This comes in the wake of an attack in San Bernardino, California. 14 people were killed in a mass shooting at a community center last Wednesday. The FBI is investigating the attack as an act of terror, with evidence that the perpetrators were inspired by ISIS. The president has been receiving low marks from the public for his handling of the battle against terrorism and will speak tonight to reassure a nervous country. Here in the studio, we're joined by NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, this address is coming from the Oval Office, not a setting the president has used very much. What's the message he's trying to send tonight?
Well, the president is trying to deliver a message of reassurance to the American public. The White House is very much aware that first the attacks in Paris and now the attacks in San Bernardino have hit very close to home for the American public. These attacks hit in places that Americans can picture themselves being, at a sporting event, at a music concert, at an office Christmas party. And so the president wants to update the public on the steps that his administration has taken, in particular since the attacks in Paris, to keep Americans safe.
And this is a big task because the public is very nervous right now, it seems.
That's right. And yet the White House has also been realistic to say, look, it's difficult to counteract these kinds of attacks when people fly below the radar.
And we're going to go to the Oval Office now in the White House where the
Good
president
evening.
Is speaking.
On Wednesday, 14 Americans were killed as they came together to celebrate the holidays. They were taken from family and friends who loved them deeply. They were white and black, Latino and Asian, immigrants and American-born, moms and dads, daughters and sons. Each of them served their fellow citizens, and all of them were part of our American family. Tonight I want to talk with you about this tragedy, the broader threat of terrorism, and how we can keep our country safe. The FBI is still gathering the facts about what happened in San Bernardino, but here's what we know. The victims were brutally murdered and injured by one of their co-workers and his wife. So far, we have no evidence that the killers were directed by a terrorist organization overseas or that they were part of a broader conspiracy here at home. But it is clear that the two of them had gone down the dark path of radicalization, embracing a perverted interpretation of Islam that calls for war against America and the West. They had stockpiled assault weapons, ammunition, and pipe bombs. So this was an act of terrorism designed to kill innocent people. Our nation has been at war with terrorists since Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 Americans on 9/11. In the process, we've hardened our defenses, from airports to financial centers to other critical infrastructure. Intelligence and law enforcement agencies have disrupted countless plots here and overseas and worked around the clock to keep us safe. Our military and counterterrorism professionals have relentlessly pursued terrorist networks overseas, disrupting safe havens in several different countries, killing Osama bin Laden, and decimating al-Qaeda's leadership. Over the last few years, however, the terrorist threat has evolved into a new phase. As we've become better at preventing complex, multifaceted attacks like 9/11, terrorists turn to less complicated acts of violence, like the mass shootings that are all too common in our society. It is this type of attack that we saw at Fort Hood in 2009, in Chattanooga earlier this year, and now in San Bernardino. And as groups like ISIL grew stronger amidst the chaos of war in Iraq and then Syria, and as the Internet erases the distance between countries, we see growing efforts by terrorists to poison the minds of people like the Boston Marathon bombers and the San Bernardino killers. For 7 years, I have confronted this evolving threat each and every morning in my intelligence briefing. And since the day I took this office, I have authorized U.S. forces to take out terrorists abroad precisely because I know how real the danger is. As Commander-in-Chief, I have no greater responsibility than the security of the American people. As a father to two young daughters who are the most precious part of my life, I know that we see ourselves with friends and co-workers at a holiday party like the one in San Bernardino. I know we see our kids in the faces of the young people killed in Paris. And I know that after so much war, many Americans are asking whether we are confronted by a cancer that has no immediate cure. Well, here's what I want you to know. The threat from terrorism is real, but we will overcome it. We will destroy ISIL and any other organization that tries to harm us. Our success won't depend on tough talk or abandoning our values or giving in to fear. That's what groups like ISIL are hoping for. Instead, we will prevail by being strong and smart, resilient and relentless, and by drawing upon every aspect of American power. Here's how. First, our military will continue to hunt down terrorist plotters in any country where it is necessary. In Iraq and Syria, airstrikes are taking out ISIL leaders, heavy weapons, oil tankers, infrastructure. And since the attacks in Paris, our closest allies, including France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, have ramped up their contributions to our military campaign, which will help us accelerate our effort to destroy ISIL. Second, we will continue to provide training and equipment to tens of thousands of Iraqi and Syrian forces fighting ISIL on the ground so that we take away their safe havens. In both countries, we're deploying special operations forces who can accelerate that offensive. We've stepped up this effort since the attacks in Paris and will continue to invest more in approaches that are working on the ground. Third, we're working with friends and allies to stop ISIL's operations, to disrupt plots, cut off their financing, and prevent them from recruiting more fighters. Since the attacks in Paris, we've surged intelligence sharing with our European allies. We're working with Turkey to seal its border with Syria. And we are cooperating with Muslim-majority countries and with our Muslim communities here at home to counter the vicious ideology that ISIL promotes online. Fourth, with American leadership, the international community has begun to establish a process and timeline to pursue ceasefires and a political resolution to the Syrian war. Doing so will allow the Syrian people and every country, including our allies, but also countries like Russia, to focus on the common goal of destroying ISIL, a group that threatens us all. This is our strategy to destroy ISIL. It is designed and supported by our military commanders and counterterrorism experts, together with 65 countries that have joined an American-led coalition. And we constantly examine our strategy to determine when additional steps are needed to get the job done. That's why I've ordered the Departments of State and Homeland Security to review the visa waiver program under which the female terrorist in San Bernardino originally came to this country. And that's why I will urge high-tech and law enforcement leaders to make it harder for terrorists to use technology to escape from justice. Now, here at home, we have to work together to address the challenge. There are several steps that Congress should take right away. To begin with, Congress should act to make sure no one on a no-fly list is able to buy a gun. What could possibly be the argument for allowing a terrorist suspect to buy a semi-automatic weapon? This is a matter of national security. We also need to make it harder for people to buy powerful assault weapons, like the ones that were used in San Bernardino. I know there are some who reject any gun safety measures, but the fact is that our intelligence and law enforcement agencies, no matter how effective they are, cannot identify every would-be mass shooter, whether that individual is motivated by ISIL or some other hateful ideology. What we can do, and must do, is make it harder for them to kill. Next, we should put in place stronger screening for those who come to America without a visa so that we can take a hard look at whether they've traveled to war zones. And we're working with members of both parties in Congress to do exactly that. Finally, if Congress believes, as I do, that we are at war with ISIL, it should go ahead and vote to authorize the continued use of military force against these terrorists. For over a year, I have ordered our military to take thousands of airstrikes against ISIL targets. I think it's time for Congress to vote to demonstrate that the American people are united and committed to this fight. My fellow Americans, these are the steps that we can take together to defeat the terrorist threat. Let me now say a word about what we should not do. We should not be drawn once more into a long and costly ground war in Iraq or Syria. That's what groups like ISIL want. They know they can't defeat us on the battlefield. ISIL fighters were part of the insurgency that we faced in Iraq. But they also know that if we occupy foreign lands, they can maintain insurgencies for years, killing thousands of our troops, draining our resources, and using our presence to draw new recruits. The strategy that we are using now, airstrikes, special forces, and working with local forces who are fighting to regain control of their own country, that is how we'll achieve a more sustainable victory. And it won't require us sending a new generation of Americans overseas to fight and die for another decade on foreign soil. Here's what else we cannot do. We cannot turn against one another by letting this fight be defined as a war between America and Islam. That, too, is what groups like ISIL want. ISIL does not speak for Islam. They are thugs and killers, part of a cult of death. And they account for a tiny fraction of a more than a billion Muslims around the world, including millions of patriotic Muslim Americans who reject their hateful ideology. Moreover, the vast majority of terrorist victims around the world are Muslim. If we're to succeed in defeating terrorism, we must enlist Muslim communities as some of our strongest allies, rather than push them away through suspicion and hate. That does not mean denying the fact that an extremist ideology has spread within some Muslim communities. It is a real problem that Muslims must confront without excuse. Muslim leaders here and around the globe have to continue working with us to decisively and unequivocally reject the hateful ideology that groups like ISIL and Al-Qaeda promote, to speak out against not just acts of violence, but also those interpretations of Islam that are incompatible with the values of religious tolerance, mutual respect, and human dignity. But just as it is the responsibility of Muslims around the world to root out misguided ideas that lead to radicalization, it is the responsibility of all Americans, of every faith, to reject discrimination. It is our responsibility to reject religious tests on who we admit into this country. It's our responsibility to reject proposals that Muslim Americans should somehow be treated differently. Because when we travel down that road, we lose. That kind of divisiveness, that betrayal of our values, plays into the hands of groups like ISIL. Muslim Americans are our friends and our neighbors, our co-workers, our sports heroes, And yes, they are our men and women in uniform who are willing to die in defense of our country. We have to remember that. My fellow Americans, I am confident we will succeed in this mission because we are on the right side of history. We were founded upon a belief in human dignity, that no matter who you are or where you come from or what you look like or what religion you practice, you are equal in the eyes of God and equal in the eyes of the law. Even in this political season, even as we properly debate what steps I and future presidents must take to keep our country safe, let's make sure we never forget what makes us exceptional. Let's not forget that freedom is more powerful than fear. That we have always met challenges, whether war or depression, natural disasters or terrorist attacks, by coming together around our common ideals as one nation and one people. So long as we stay true to that tradition, I have no doubt that America will prevail. Thank you. God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
You've just heard President Obama speaking from the Oval Office. He was addressing the shootings in San Bernardino that occurred on Wednesday and the broader threat from terrorism. The president named the attack in California last week an act of terrorism, linking it to strong attacks from 9/11 to the attack on Fort Hood in 2009. President said the threat from terrorism is real. He also pledged to destroy ISIS through military and intelligence operations. The president also spoke of working with Muslim communities, both here in the United States and in countries around the world. And he talked about the availability of guns in this country. We need to make it harder for people to buy powerful assault weapons, the president said. And he called on Congress to vote to authorize the use of military force against ISIS. You are listening to special coverage from NPR News. And joining us here in the studio are NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley and NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson. Scott, right before the speech, we were talking about the fact that the president needed to reassure the public. Did he do that in this speech?
Well, he certainly tried, Lynn, and he also confronted those critics who said, look, he's been taking ISIS too lightly, that he hasn't taken this threat seriously. As you said, he named this as an act of terrorism, and he said, I take that threat seriously because I confront it every day in my daily presidential briefing when I get the intelligence reports from around the world, and I do take the threat of terrorism seriously. He also talked about the evolution of the terrorist threat from the sort of spectacular coordinated attacks we saw on September 11th of 2001 to the more free-floating and harder to detect attacks like we saw in Paris and like we've seen in San Bernardino.
Carrie, did the president shed any new light on the investigation of what's going on in California?
He did talk, Lynn, about the notion that these people may have had their minds poisoned via terrorists they connected to over the internet. We do have some evidence from law enforcement sources that the female attacker, Tashfeen Malik, pledged allegiance to the leader of the Islamic State on Facebook right around the time of the attacks. And we're also told by other law enforcement sources that the male attacker, Sayyid Farouk, communicated with other people electronically and via the telephone on the FBI radar screen, though the extent and substance of those communications remains a bit unknown for now. But, Lynn, this appears to be a case at this early stage in the investigation where people may have self-radicalized through communications with each other in this married couple and through the internet. And as Scott said, those kinds of radicalization efforts are very, very hard for authorities to detect, in part because they're communicating with each other and they may not be planning the same kind of spectacular attack on an airliner, for instance, or in a train station that would leave a lot of digital fingerprints. So,
yeah, and the president talked about this evolving into terrorism, evolving into a new phase, Scott.
That's right, and he said that the United States and its allies have had to adjust to that as well. Since the attacks in Paris, the U.S., France, now the U.K., Germany, they're all stepping up their attacks on ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. At the same time, he cautioned against a sort of massive land war by U.S. forces in those countries. He said, look, that's what ISIS wants. They can't defeat us unless they can draw us in to that kind of sustained and very costly war. So he cautioned against a sort of military overreaction to this attack.
And he also talked about guns.
He did. Of course, this is something he's talked about many, many times, whether we're talking about folks who are inspired by jihadist ideology or right-wing ideology or just the demons of mental illness. But the gun violence has been a persistent challenge for this president.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.
Special coverage continues right here on 88.5 KPLU and streaming at kplu.org.
The law offices of J. Michael Gallagher. For over 30 years, Michael Gallagher has been working to preserve parents' relationships with their children and to make sure child support payments are not financially debilitating. More information at don'tbeaweekendparent.com.
All right, Ed Ronco, time for the lightning round. I'll give you the clues and you name that radio show. Get all five right and you win. Ready?
Ready.
Leaves, rain, Halloween,
fall, things considered.
Nanotech, babies, Ozzy Osbourne's IQ,
small, things considered.
Banana Republic, Sunglass Hut, PF,
mall, things considered.
Caesar, Druids, Visigoths,
Gaul, things considered.
All of the above and the rest of the entire universe,
all things considered.
The winner and still champion.
Weekdays from 3 to 6:30 on KPLU.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. Moments ago, President Obama delivered an address from the Oval Office about national security and terrorism, this in response to the recent attack in San Bernardino. Joining me now is NPR religion correspondent Tom Gelton. Tom, a lot has been made of the language President Obama has used or declined to use in describing terrorists who claim Islam as a cause. He did not use the phrase radical Islam in tonight's speech, and he spoke about not stigmatizing Muslims. Why would the president avoid using that term in particular before we get into anything else?
Well, then, he was very careful in choosing the words he used to describe what is going on. And that is, I mean, he said, we cannot let this be defined as a war between America and Islam, because that would feed into ISIS's narrative. Some people say that he's way too careful. He talked about, as you mentioned, he talked about an act of terrorism. He didn't say it was Islamic terrorism. He's come under withering criticism from Republican presidential candidates for not saying that the enemy is radical Islam, for not using the term Islamic terrorism. On the other hand, Lynn, I was struck that he actually went further in that direction, in a sense, tonight than he has gone before. He said, there is no denying that extremist ideology has spread within Muslim communities. He talked about people adopting a perverted view of Islam. So he was pretty clear that he was not avoiding the words. And the other thing is that I think that the argument can be made that what is gained by calling this, radical Islam or something? It's not as though you can go to war against a religion or even an ideology. And so I think that the administration, for practical reasons, has been very careful in using in the terminology that it uses. And we saw that again tonight.
Yeah. He also was very clear about that the country needs to reject discrimination and that his administration plans to reach out to Muslim communities both in this country and internationally.
That's right. And I think, Lynn, what the fear is that if you start talking about radical Islam, a lot of Americans aren't going to distinguish between Islam generally and radical Islam. And that's the last thing that they want, is to provoke some kind of generalized anti-Islam sentiment or anti-Muslim sentiment that, as he says, would just feed into this narrative that ISIS is putting forth, that there is a war between the West and Islam.
NPR's Tom Gelton. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman joins us now. Tom, the president has reaffirmed his strategy of airstrikes and special forces to fight ISIS on the ground in Iraq and Syria. The president has faced much criticism for not having a strong enough strategy against ISIS. Talk about how they've been stepping up the fight in recent weeks.
Well, they have been stepping up the fight, but some call these half measures. He talked about increased airstrikes. He talked about the United Kingdom and France helping out with those airstrikes. But it's important to remember that the United States does maybe 75 to 80% or more of all those airstrikes. He also talked about the U.S.'s training tens of thousands of troops in Iraq and Syria. But the problem, Lynn, is this, that they don't have enough local troops in Syria to move and take land. And on the Iraqi side, they have enough troops, but they just don't seem willing to take territory back. They're rimming around Ramadi right now, and they're not moving in sufficient force to take back that city. So you're in essence, what you have here is the U.S. in some respects standing back, helping out, but not wanting to get in and do it themselves. They're waiting for these troops, which in Syria aren't in sufficient number, and Iraq aren't willing to fight. So that's the problem. So they still have this caliphate there, what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Joe Dunford, calls their center of gravity, their sense of strength and power. And the president was right. It has been contained somewhat in Iraq and Syria, but as far as it decreasing insufficient amounts, you're not going to be seeing that for a long time, maybe years. That's the problem.
And he was very clear there's not going to be any ground war. He said this is what ISIS wants.
He said that. He said you don't want them killing thousands of our troops. And he talked about 50,000 U.S. troops he didn't want to send a few weeks back. But some people saw that as a straw man, that you need more special operations troops than the several dozen they'll be sending over. And you also need troops from Saudi Arabia and Jordan and UAE and some of the regional Arab powers. That has not happened yet. You're seeing mostly Western troops on the ground training these forces in Iraq and Syria, and they keep telling and asking the Saudis and other allies to step up. They're just not doing it yet. That's a serious problem.
But he talked about getting more help from allies, didn't he?
Well, again, from the United Kingdom and also France, but not enough from the Arab allies. It's a serious problem.
All right. At this point, I'd like to welcome Seamus Hughes to the conversation. He is Deputy Director of the Program on Extremism at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Hughes.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I understand that you have conducted an extensive review of Americans who were linked to participation with ISIS. Can you tell us something about your research and give us a snapshot of who these people are?
Yeah, so this week we released a new study that essentially looked at 71 individuals that are in the legal system for joining ISIS. We went through about 7,000 pages of legal documents to get a sense of what that profile looks like. And the gist of it is essentially it runs the spectrum. There's a diversity of profile. So they tend to be younger. They're 26 years old. But one-third of the cases, they're 21 years or younger. They tend to be male. But they're old, they're young, they're rich, they're poor. It kind of runs the gamut when it looks at the actual profile of people that are joining ISIS in the legal system.
What's the social media platform of choice for ISIS recruitment?
Yeah, Twitter is absolutely the social media platform of choice, although in the last few weeks we've seen them kind of transition over. So over a six-month period, we looked at about 300 Americans we believe to be ISIS supporters on Twitter to get a sense of what the scene looks like, and our researchers kind of followed that scene. And it's essentially an echo chamber, you know, where everyone kind of knows each other. They're sharing memes and comedic jokes, and they're kicking out dissenters. And they essentially set up their own little community online, which helps to reinforce their views.
So in general, how do they use the social media, and how are people self-radicalized through social media? We heard that the woman involved in this attack posted on Facebook, apparently, right before it happened.
Yeah, we've seen in the past people posting their pledges of support. The question then becomes, you know, when does somebody actually cross that threshold to become, you know, a violent act or a legal issue? The way they use the online space is kind of threefold. The first way is they groom people online. So we saw in real time a number of people that were essentially brought into the fold by ISIS spotters who recognized, you know, their naivete and kind of brought them in. The other way to use it essentially is act as travel agent for people that want to travel. So they're providing logistical support. You know, they're giving numbers of people to call when you land in Turkey so you can be able to cross the border. and get into the so-called caliphate. And then the third way is essentially the devil on the shoulder, the people that are egging people on in the homeland saying, you know, if you can't make it a Syrian Iraq, do what you can where you can. And we saw that in sharp contrast in Garland.
There's a lot of curiosity about the woman who was involved in the San Bernardino attack. She is from Pakistan. A lot of people are wondering, was she the main motivation behind this? What do you know about the role that women are playing in ISIS and as future threats?
Yeah, so the role of women in terrorism writ large isn't particularly novel. We've seen them play prominent roles in different terrorist organizations. And this year alone, we've had 10 women that have been arrested for ISIS-related charges in the U.S. So they play the role of, you know, recruiter or propagandist, sometimes the spotters online. In this case, when we talk about a couple, you think about it similar to the online space with the echo chamber. You essentially have a reinforcing views on each type of thing. What is novel on this is the role of a woman as a mass shooter in the U.S. That's something we haven't seen in the past.
Mr. Hughes, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Seamus Hughes is Deputy Director of the Program on Extremism at George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. And we're turning now to how the speech may affect American diplomatic efforts. We're joined by NPR State Department correspondent Michelle Kellerman and also by Abdurrahim Fukara. He is from the Al Jazeera. He's the Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera. First of all, Mr. Fukara, how are American allies in the Middle East responding to the recent attacks in San Bernardino?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of concern about what happened in terms of how that may shape U.S. foreign policy down the road towards that part of the Middle East. People are very mindful of some of the proclamations coming from the right and from the Republican camp during the presidential election. But obviously, the concern right now is for American Muslims, if you will, because, you know, echoes of, you know, all the things that are being said about American Muslims are reaching that part of the world. I should also say that probably governments in the region are much more preoccupied with what's going on within their borders, whether you're talking about Egypt or Yemen or Syria or Saudi. There's a lot of concern with domestic situations, but certainly they would be watching very closely and listening to what the president said tonight.
Michelle Kellerman, do you feel the president's remarks represented any real change in strategy, or is this just a change in tone?
Certainly not on the diplomatic strategy, or even on the military. I mean, he talked about that the U.S. should not be drawn into a long, costly ground war. He talked about intensifying airstrikes, the other things that the U.S. is already doing, trying to cut off funding streams to ISIS, and also supporting Iraqi and Syrian fighters on the ground. You know, what the U.S. has been trying to do diplomatically is to solve the broader war in Syria, and that is to get peace talks off the ground, getting all these warring sides and their proxies to agree on a peace process, and then focus their attention solely on ISIS. And that has been just a huge challenge since the beginning, because there are so many countries that have different interests in Syria, and the conflict has dragged on so long, and ISIS has really been able to take advantage of that chaos.
Mr. Fukara, many American lawmakers feel that more aggressive strikes in Syria could help to end this threat. What do you think about that?
Well, the general feeling in the region is obviously that airstrikes are not enough. They've proven to a lot of people in recent years that they're not enough. You know, we've seen not just the United States, we've seen, as the president said, many of its allies actually intensify their military effort from the air. And yet, in recent months, we have seen the threat of ISIS being described as getting worse, not getting better. The problem, as the president said in his address, is if the air campaign is not enough, then what do you do? Many governments in the Middle East are unwilling to put their own boots on the ground in Syria or in Iraq. And as I said earlier, many of these governments are facing domestic challenges, so the effort to push them to put boots on the ground in Syria or Iraq would have to be Herculean, but still not guaranteed that they would lead to that outcome.
Tom Bowman, you were saying earlier that there has to be more support from Muslim countries.
That's right. You need Muslim troops on the ground, not Western troops that can be called crusaders. That's the challenge. And again, you can increase the airstrikes as they have done. There are 8,000 or 9,000 airstrikes yet, but they still hold Raqqa in Syria. They still hold Mosul in Iraq and Ramadi. They still hold some of these major cities. The Iraqi forces outside of the Kurds really aren't fighting that hard. That's a serious problem. And again, in Syria, you don't have sufficient Kurdish forces or this new Syrian Arab coalition they talk about. They have maybe 4,000 or 5,000 Syrian Arab troops. And I'm told that they've said it publicly, they are not sufficient to take the self-proclaimed capital of Raqqa back from ISIS. So then the question is, you can bomb and bomb all you want, and what do you do? You need ground troops to take ground. It's as simple as that.
Right. And remember, the Syrian military is really fighting other opponents of Bashar al-Assad and not taking on ISIS. Russia has come into this conflict as well with airstrikes, but backing up Bashar al-Assad's regime rather than going after solely ISIS. So again, there's just so many layers here that the U.S. and all the countries have to work through.
NPR's Michelle Gellerman, thanks so much for joining us. And thank you also, Abdurrahim Fukara from Al Jazeera. And we're moving on now to Jamie Gorelick. She's a member of the 9/11 Commission and a Washington lawyer, a high-ranking official in both the Justice and Defense Departments in the Clinton administration. What is your overall reaction to what the president said in his speech?
Well, I think the American people were looking for a sign of strong leadership, in essence, that he gets it and that he understands how afraid people are. And I thought he made a very strong effort to do that. He spoke about what it is like as a father to see fear in the eyes of children. And he then went on to say, here is our plan. Here is our determination. Here is how we are going to be secure. If people don't feel secure in a country's leadership, they find attractively simple solutions compelling when they don't make any sense. And I think he was trying to say, we're here, we got it, we're on it.
There's a lot of conversation about how terrorism has changed since 9/11, when Al-Qaeda was the major threat. Now we have a sort of ground up, or as we've been talking about it, people who are self-actualized terrorists, as opposed to being ordered to do terrorist attacks from above. Talk a little bit more about how it has changed since 9/11.
Well, we've seen a series of lone wolf or semi-lone wolf events by people who were inspired by a very radicalized view of Islam. I mean, in the 9/11 Commission report, we called these people Islamists, that is, people who wanted to impose on others their very radical view of their religion. And we see them in pockets around the United States. And the trick is trying to figure out how to identify them and how to prevent these acts. One of the ways that you do that, and he talked about this, is to have the religion itself, its leaders, condemn what is happening here and make it unspeakable as a Muslim to do this, which it is for most Muslims, of course, around the world. And I think that's what the president was talking about.
Carrie Johnson.
One of the things we heard the president say, and we've really, Lynn, heard Attorney General Loretta Lynch and FBI Director James Comey say in the last few days, including in an emergency or last-minute briefing to a group of reporters, which I attended, was, we need the Muslim community to stand up. They represent, to some extent, our strongest allies in policing this kind of radical behavior. And we need people in communities, neighborhoods, and mosques to call authorities when somebody may be acting strangely, when they notice somebody may be getting withdrawn. and just place the call, is the plea from law enforcement, and we can investigate these matters quietly, secretly, and figure out whether someone's just having a bad day or whether there's something more worrisome to consider here in terms of radicalization. That's because all the tripwires here in the U.S. are set up to catch the big attacks that require a lot of planning and communication. And when people are sitting in their living rooms or in their basements on Twitter or on their cell phone reading hateful extremist propaganda, very few people may know about that except their friends and neighbors and family members. So law enforcement is really relying on the Muslim community for help here.
Yeah. Any dangers there, though, in terms of asking neighbors to report on neighbors?
Already there's been a backlash to those comments Friday afternoon. There's a long and rather sad history of the FBI infringing on civil rights going back to the Martin Luther King era and others. And many folks are concerned that this kind of self-policing could cross a line if it's done poorly.
NPR's Carrie Johnson. And thank you very much, Dame Gorelick, for joining us as well. And you are listening to special coverage from NPR News.
Special coverage continues right here on 88.5 KPLU and streaming at kplu.org. The 19th annual KPLU Christmas Jam Concert and live broadcast is this Thursday at noon. It's at a new venue, the Karen Hilly Phillips Performing Arts Center in Eastfold Hall at Pacific Lutheran University. This year's special guest is saxophonist Anton Schwartz, performing holiday classics with his quartet and the PLU Jazz Ensemble. The concert is free. You can find more information at our website, kplu.org. Rain right now in Seattle, 54 degrees at 540 on 88.5 KPLU.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. We're covering President Obama's remarks about national security and terrorism policy. I am joined once again by NPR's White House correspondent, Scott Horsley. Scott, I understand you have a recap for us.
That's right, Lynn. The president began his address from the Oval Office this evening by speaking to what we know about the mass shooting in San Bernardino last week. We'd heard already about reports that the killers were inspired by the self-described Islamic State. Here's what the president had to say.
So far, we have no evidence that the killers were directed by a terrorist organization overseas or that they were part of a broader conspiracy here at home. But it is clear that the two of them had gone down the dark path of radicalization, embracing a perverted interpretation of Islam that calls for war against America and the West. They had stockpiled assault weapons, ammunition, and pipe bombs. So this was an act of terrorism designed to kill innocent people.
This is the first time the president himself has described this so definitively as a terrorist act, and one the White House knows hits the American public very close to home.
And what does the president say he plans to do about it?
Well, first of all, the president stressed that he's taking this seriously, and not just now, but that this is a threat he's been taking seriously for the 7 years he's been in office. He gets daily briefings about all the threats that are posed against the United States. And during that time, he said there has been an evolution among terrorist actors away from the sort of spectacular and highly coordinated attack we saw on September 11th of 2001 and towards the more fragmented, you might say, low-budget style of attack we saw in Paris and now in San Bernardino. That is a real challenge for law enforcement, but it's a challenge the president insists the United States can overcome.
The threat from terrorism is real, but we will overcome it. We will destroy ISIL and any other organization that tries to harm us. Our success won't depend on tough talk or abandoning our values or giving in to fear. That's what groups like ISIL are hoping for. Instead, we will prevail by being strong and smart, resilient and relentless, and by drawing upon every aspect of American power.
And when the president talks about every aspect of American power, he means not only military action, although that's certainly a part of it, but also, for example, targeting the financing of groups like ISIS. Since the Paris attacks, the U.S. has made a coordinated effort to go after the oil tankers that are moving oil that provides revenue for ISIS. More than 100 have been destroyed since the Paris attacks. The president also talked about taking steps to tighten up the visa waiver program and make it more difficult for dangerous people to enter the United States. And he returned to the subject of gun control, something he's talked about many times in the past. Tonight, he reiterated his argument that people who are on a no-fly list should also be barred from purchasing weapons. Of course, neither of the killers in this case was on a no-fly list, so that would not necessarily have made a difference in this instance. The president also stressed that Congress should vote to authorize the use of military force to explicitly give him the green light for the kind of airstrikes he's been carrying out for a year now. At the same time, he cautioned against a full-style Iraq-type invasion.
We should not be drawn once more into a long and costly ground war in Iraq or Syria. That's what groups like ISIL want. They know they can't defeat us on the battlefield. ISIL fighters were part of the insurgency that we faced in Iraq. But they also know that if we occupy foreign lands, they can maintain insurgencies for years, killing thousands of our troops, draining our resources, and using our presence to draw new recruits.
Scott, the president also addressed steps that Americans should and should not take here at home.
Yes, he said Americans should fight the temptation to draw lines within our community. And he said we should not do anything that might vilify Muslims, noting that Muslims are overwhelmingly the victims of groups like ISIS.
Just as it is the responsibility of Muslims around the world to root out misguided ideas that lead to radicalization, it is the responsibility of all Americans, of every faith, to reject discrimination. It is our responsibility to reject religious tests on who we admit into this country. It's our responsibility to reject proposals that Muslim Americans should somehow be treated differently. Because when we travel down that road, we lose.
Scott Horsley, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
We're going to get some more perspective on the Muslim American community now. We're joined by Linda Sarsour. She's the executive director of the Arab American Association of New York. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What was your reaction to President Obama's speech and to how he's handling these terror threats and the way he spoke about the Muslim community?
I'll be honest with you, it's the same old script that we've heard, and what's very concerning to me is this idea that when we talk about extremism and terrorism, we focus and are obsessed with the Muslim community. He didn't mention, you know, the Planned Parenthood shooting, who's rooting out extremists in other communities. I want a united front in the United States of America that is going to address all forms of extremism, regardless of who they are, what their faith is, their race. And that includes ISIL and its followers. But the fact that we're talking about in this country, gun control has now become second tier when we are more likely to be killed in a mass shooting or by a shooter with a gun than we are by terrorists. So this idea that we're distracted by this larger issue when we really need gun control. How did these people purchase these legal, all of the weapons that these two people in San Bernardino had were all legally purchased. And the fact that we're focusing this idea of extremism and extremist ideology as if it's only particular to Muslims and ignoring the multiple terrorist attacks that have happened, including in South Charleston at the church, including white supremacist shooting at Black Lives Matter protesters, and the recent Planned Parenthood shooting.
I think the president was and intended to directly address the issue of ISIS because of the most recent shooting and the idea that there is a sort of self-radicalization going on. What I'm wondering, how did you respond to the idea that he talked about a perverted idea of Islam?
I think it's important that we continue, and I do commend the president for, on multiple occasions, clarifying that ISIL is not Islam, and they do not represent Muslims or 1.7 billion of us across the world. And I don't even like to say that it's a perverted version of Islam. It is not Islam. I mean, if people understood that the ideology of ISIS or how ISIS was even created in the first place, it's in a political context. It's in a geopolitical context, and I think it's important to understand that they don't represent Islam. And I also want to make sure that the president has to clarify that radicalization in the Muslim American community is not an epidemic. we've had only, you know, 160 potential people who are supposedly trying to travel to places like Syria. We're about 7 million Muslims in America. So I want the American people to understand that Muslims actually have helped foil at least 40% of alleged plots. So he does not have to enlist us in cooperation with law enforcement. Our communities are already in cooperation with law enforcement. We've been in cooperation with law enforcement because our safety is also a top priority, the safety of our community members and our children. Our safety is the same safety that any other American wants in this country. And I have a hard time understanding why people can't understand that we are their fellow Americans and we care about our country just like anybody else.
Tom Gelton, did the president go far enough in making the point, some of the points that Linda is talking about, that this does not represent the Muslim community?
I think he was pretty clear on that. He did say at one point that Muslims have a responsibility, quote, to speak out against extremists and extremism. And my guess is that Linda sort of bristles at that a little bit, because the truth of the matter is that every time there is some kind of terrorist attack, you immediately see a press conference by CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and other Muslim groups. And I think that I don't want to speak for Linda, and Linda can say this herself, but, you know, the impression that I get is that a lot of Muslim Americans and Muslim American organizations sort of get weary of condemning every attack that comes out, as if that's sort of their immediate obligation. And the fact that the president did call on them to take to speak out against extremists probably, you know, is a bit of a sore point. He did emphasize that, and something that I hear a lot, both in my previous job as national security correspondent and now as religion correspondent, that if this extremist ideology, this perverted perverted ideology that is carried out in the name of Islam, if it's to be defeated, it's probably going to have to be defeated by Muslims themselves. And I think that the president certainly suggested that. And so, you know, we're going to have to depend, I think, in the end, on the Muslim community to isolate those voices who have really done so much harm in the name of Islam.
And Sarsour, just final word to you on this.
I think, again, you know, asking for the Muslim community to condemn already, it creates a fallacy that we are somehow connected to ISIS, or that we have to condemn another group that we believe does not represent us. When we stand up to condemn violence, any violence in this country, it's because we are human, because we are Americans, because we are New Yorkers. It's not because I'm Muslim, and I think that's an important distinction. We would never ask any other faith community in this country or any other race group to stand up and condemn acts of violence committed by people within their groups. And the fact that this has only happened when directed at the Muslim community is something that I personally can't accept.
Linda Sarsour is Executive Director of the Arab American Association of New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
As in the San Bernardino attacks, local authorities often find themselves as the first line of detection and defense in domestic terrorism. Joining us now to talk more about that is NPR correspondent Martin Kosty. Thanks for joining us, Martin.
Yeah, sure.
How have local authorities been preparing themselves to respond to these kinds of terror threats?
Well, even in the past few years since the terrorist attacks on Mumbai, there's been this sort of quiet movement inside of local law enforcement to prepare for more decentralized, multiple attacker style incidents like this. And so a number of big cities have already been sort of rethinking some of their contingency plans. They've been doing sort of what they call tabletop exercises, simulations to kind of make sure that they have, that the different agencies that will have to come together on something like that already kind of know what they'll do when that happens. This has been on their mind now for a while. It's not a new concept. But I have to say, in terms of police culture in this country, if it's true that we're now looking at a new threat of self-radicalized extremists attacking without any kind of command or control, that really puts a lot more pressure on local police than ever before, and that's creating some real new tensions for them, because they're at a moment post-Ferguson where they're trying to sort of reestablish sort of what their identity is as police are, if they're more the community-oriented cop that we saw in the 90s or more of the sort of warrior cop that we saw post 9/11, you know, that tension is there. And now if this is going to happen, they've got to decide to some degree whether they're going to be sort of the gung-ho, kitted-up guys who go in guns blazing, or if they're the community police officer who has good relationships with minority communities and can maybe suss out some of these problems before they happen. And a lot of people say, in theory, you can do both, but it's not easy to pull that off. And I think this threat that we saw in San Bernardino just makes that clear, that a lot of local police sort of feel torn between this sense of being a militarized officer or more of a community officer.
NPR correspondent Martin Costi, thanks so much, Martin.
You're welcome.
NPR political reporter Sarah McCammon has been following the reaction to the president's speech from the campaign trail. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So what are some of the candidates saying?
Well, you know, it was interesting. Ahead of the president's speech, Donald Trump announced that he was going to be live tweeting the whole thing. And he tweeted a few times, mostly retweeted some of his fans. And a lot of his tweets, frankly, were aesthetic. He said that the podium the president was speaking from looked odd. And when it was over, he said, "Is that all there is?" Marco Rubio, meanwhile, said that, you know, he criticized the president for only showing emotion, he said, when he criticizes the GOP. And he said on Fox News that he's been hearing from people who are very scared, avoiding holiday travel, avoiding being in public places like stadiums and malls this time of year because they're afraid. And basically said that the president really just came out with more of the same strategy that he says got us where we are now.
And what about Hillary Clinton? She's been trying to strike a tougher tone against ISIS than the president. What are we hearing from her?
Right. I think you hear Hillary Clinton trying to strike an aggressive tone against ISIS while balancing that with concerns about being sensitive to Muslim Americans. This morning, she said she hoped the president would announce intensified efforts to fight terrorism. She said she thinks it'd be a good idea to partner with private sector companies like Facebook to crack down on terrorist organizing and propaganda. But she also cautioned against using the phrase radical Islam and stressed that it's important to be aware that the vast majority of Muslims in our country are peaceful. So you hear a different tone there, certainly, than the Republicans.
But this whole question of terrorism really is becoming a dominant issue in the campaign at this point, both in Republican and Democratic side, right?
I think it has been for a while. We've heard candidates like Ted Cruz calling on President Obama to use the phrase radical Islamic terrorist for weeks now and others, but that's just intensified in the last couple of weeks. You're hearing more of it.
All right. Thanks so much, NPR's Sarah McCammon.
Thanks.
We're joined now by Ron Christie. He is a GOP strategist and former special assistant to President George W. Bush and deputy assistant to Vice President Cheney. Thanks for being with us.
Of course. Happy to join you tonight.
What was your reaction to the president's speech, and do you feel that he is saying anything new about how his administration is going to handle threats of terrorism?
No, actually, candidly, I was a little bit disappointed. I think this was an opportunity. So many Americans are so scared about what's going on in America. They're so scared because they recognize that ISIS is not contained. ISIS is not in a position of being curtailed, and our president says we've contained them and they're on the run. And when I listened to him tonight, I thought the most important thing the president of the United States can do is reassure the American people that I'm on the job, I understand what the threat is, and I understand your fear. And I think for all the indicia of what the president needed to say tonight, he didn't say it.
You don't think he said any of that?
No, I don't.
I'm on the job.
Well, I mean, listening to his comments, we are going to redouble our efforts. We're going to do this. Why redouble your efforts? What have you been doing beforehand? Why haven't you redoubled your efforts beforehand? Why are you telling us on primetime television what your strategy is? In fighting and waging and winning a war on terrorism, you should never reveal to the enemy what your tactics, measures, and metrics are for defeating them. And it was almost of, here's what I'm doing, but what I haven't done. And now our enemies know what the President of the United States is thinking and how he wants to wage this war, ostensibly, against terrorism. I thought it was the wrong tone and the wrong tact for him to have taken tonight.
All right. Thanks so much, Ron Christie.
Of course.
Ron Christie is a GOP strategist and former special assistant to President George W. Bush and deputy assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney. Tom Bowman, give us a summary of where we're headed now with this new kind of threat of terrorism and the administration's approach toward it.
Well, in Iraq and Syria against ISIS, they have stepped up airstrikes, but again, the criticism is they're not sufficient enough. And even though France and Great Britain have joined in, the bulk of airstrikes are still being conducted by the United States. Now, what the president has agreed to do is send in dozens of special operation troops into Syria. They have not arrived yet. They will train and advise the Arab fighters and the Kurdish fighters there. He's also setting up a targeting force in northern Iraq to work with forces up there. There'll be intelligence analysts. There'll be some trigger pullers, as they say, commandos going out to snatch and grab ISIS leaders, particularly along the border between Iraq and Syria. But again, there's criticism that these are half measures, and a lot of people a number of critics have criticized the president for really taking boots off the ground initially to say that we're not going to put American boots on the ground. And they say that was a problem. You're telling your adversary what you're not going to do, and that's something you never do.
NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, thanks so much for being with us. And thanks to NPR's Tom Gelton as well, and Carrie Johnson, and Sarah McCammon. Thanks so much. You've been listening to special coverage from NPR News. Our coverage will continue on Morning Edition and at NPR.org.
You've been listening to special coverage right here on KPLU 88.5 Tacoma, Seattle, KPLI 90.1 Olympia, KVIX 89.3 Port Angeles, Victoria, KPLK 88.9 Cedro Woolley, and streaming worldwide at kplu.org. It's 5:59, 54 degrees right now in Seattle. We've got all blues on the way, but first, time for Stardate.
Stardate, December 6th. In the space exploration business, you seldom get a do-over. But the Japanese Space Agency is hoping for just that. A spacecraft that failed to enter orbit around Venus 5 years ago today may be able to do so soon. Akatsuki was launched in 2010. It was scheduled to enter orbit around Venus on December 6th of that year. From that perch, it would use an infrared camera to peer through the planet's clouds and study its dense, hot atmosphere. Akatsuki would also look for hints of active volcanoes on the surface and listen for the crackle of lightning in the atmosphere. But an engine failure scuttled those plans. The craft continued to orbit the sun, though, and controllers worked out a plan to bring it close to Venus this month. If all goes well, it'll enter orbit in the next day or two. It'll be much farther from Venus than originally planned, so its view of the planet won't be as sharp. And many of its systems have degraded during its time in space. What's more, some of Akatsuki's mission has been accomplished by a European craft, which completed its work a year ago. It confirmed that Venus's clouds produce lightning and found strong evidence of active volcanoes. Still, nudging Akatsuki into orbit would be a big achievement, giving a planetary explorer a second chance. And the probe's target is in great view. It's the morning star. Tomorrow, it's close to the lower left of the crescent moon, a beautiful pairing in the dawn sky. We have more astronomy news in Stardate magazine. Subscription information at stardate.org. For the University of Texas at Austin McDonald Observatory, I'm Sandy Wood.
Our Puget Sound area where the forecast calls for rain tonight, lows around 47, breezy with south wind to 29, wind gusts to 38 miles per hour tonight. And for Monday, rain is in the forecast. And yes, the overall look at the weather is a heavy rain could cause river flooding by Tuesday night, a series of weather systems moving through the area in the next few days. Heavy rain is forecast at times through Tuesday night in the Cascades and Olympics with 6 to 12 inches of rain between Sunday night and Tuesday night. The lowlands are forecasted to get 2 to 5 inches and the coast 3 to 7 inches during the same time frame. So obviously rainfall this heavy could cause some flooding on rivers by Tuesday night. Rivers in the Cascades from the Nooksack in the north to the Cowlitz in the south. Also, Olympic Peninsula rivers could flood if this rain occurs. And they're even saying that rivers such as the Chehalis and its tributaries could flood. So please be careful. Right now in Seattle, it's just light rain at the moment, 54 degrees. Olympia light rain, 50 degrees. And if you're in Bellingham listening at 88.7, it's overcast and 54 degrees. Whew. All right. Glad we got that out of the way. Good evening. I'm John Kessler, and thanks for tuning in Sunday night, 6 o'clock, and I'm ready to go with all blues all night long. I'll be featuring my top 10 blues picks of the year, and we'll start that in just a few minutes, but I want to get the show started right now with Little Walter up the line. Welcome to All Blues on 88.5.
You used to love me. You said I was hard to side. Trying to drive my love away. I'm cutting out. Girl, I'm going back up the line. If I stay another day, it's going to drive me out of my mind. Took me from my home. I was nothing but a child. Made all kind of promises. Me, I know it was a line of jive. Good night.